This is Illinois in Focus, a production of America's Talking Network. I'm Greg Bishop. Coming up, we'll review the week's top stories about the latest revelations in a case of alleged workers' comp fraud with political connections, a COVID-19 executive order getting blocked, the state's economy, an election update, and more. Plus, we'll get commentary from the Center Square publisher Chris Krug and executive editor Dan McCaleb about the Bears Stadium, college costs, the proposed constitutional amendment, monkeypox, and more. That's ahead with Illinois in Focus, a production of America's Talking Network. Listen to all our podcasts at americastalking.com. I'm Greg Bishop.
If you're tired of the divisive rhetoric in our country today, then America's Talking Network is for you. America's Talking Network is a new podcast hub where you can find civil conversations.
What does America need to be saved from?
The birth of my son is the birth of this channel, because when he was born, it completely changed the way I think about the world.
Find out what's happening in our country.
And of course, everyone's prices are going up around the country. If you've been to the grocery store, you've seen it. If you've made a budget, you probably had to increase your monthly allotment for a lot of different things.
And find out what's happening right here in our backyard of Illinois.
The price you pay at the pump, wherever you're buying your gasoline in Illinois, is all inclusive of the taxes that are built into this thing.
That sort of explains why Illinois' average is significantly higher than the national average.
The only agenda that America's Talking Network has is to get America talking again. Go to americastalking.com to check out all of our podcasts. Once again, that's americastalking.com.
This is Illinois in Focus, the production of America's Talking Network. I'm Greg Bishop. Here's some of the top stories from the past week. The alleged workers' compensation fraud of a former state employee and Pritzker campaign worker continues to not be prosecuted. Public records show in January, a CMS risk management official sent a memo to Attorney General Kwame Raoul's office urging a case against Jenny Thornley's alleged workers' compensation fraud be referred for prosecution. In February, the AG's office forwarded the memo to the Sangamon County State's Attorney's Office, which had already been replaced by a special prosecutor in a separate overtime fraud allegation against Thornley. The AG's office said it did not have original jurisdiction. Raoul's Republican opponent, Tom DeVore, said state law and the appellate prosecutor's office have been clear.
The Attorney General's office has original jurisdiction and has prosecuted every work comp fraud case that we've ever had in the state of Illinois. It is the Attorney General's case to handle. They tried to deflect from it.
Last week, Raoul called concerns over the handling of the case a nothing burger. He said there's a typical conflict and said they referred the case to the appellate prosecutor. The appellate prosecutor said they have no such order from the court. DeVore said this is obfuscation.
Because they know if they bring charges against Jenny Thornley for this work comp fraud, that it's going to implicate, from a conspiracy perspective, people in the governor's office, and maybe Governor Pritzker himself. That's why they're all deflecting and pushing it away off their desk.
The taxpayer cost to pay Thornley for unfounded sexual assault allegations is more than $158,000 in medical, expense, investigative, and disability payments. Claims of fraud in the politically sensitive case have not been prosecuted. Public records show the CMS risk management official sent a memo in January to Raoul's office that the claim's been politicized, and Thornley is, quote, quick to let everyone know of her political friendship with Governor Pritzker and his wife. Governor Pritzker says he doesn't know anything other than what's been reported by the media in those allegations. Documents show former Illinois State Police Merit Board employee Jenny Thornley listed the governor's office as her employer and Pritzker himself as her supervisor, with a separate listing for workers' comp claim listing the governor's general counsel, Ann Spillane, as her supervisor. Despite records alleging Thornley even sent First Lady M.K. Pritzker a text saying, I need J.B. to know, the governor Thursday denied knowing anything about it.
Nothing other than what I read in the newspaper about it. The truth is, if somebody committed workman's comp fraud, they should be held accountable.
Republican Attorney General candidate Tom DeVore agreed.
Ann Spillane, his general counsel, if you take the governor's word for it, was acting alone, because the documents are clear that she materially participated in procuring those payments to Jenny Thornley based upon a fraudulent workman's compensation application.
In April 2021, Emily Fox, an employee of the Illinois State Police Merit Board, filed a lawsuit on behalf of the people against Thornley, alleging she committed workers' comp fraud, and the governor's office was complicit. In oral arguments over Attorney General Kwame Raoul's motion to dismiss that case in February, Fox's attorney said the lawsuit was the only way to get accountability because the AG wasn't prosecuting the alleged fraud. After several different reasons provided since the start of the saga as to why Raoul isn't prosecuting the case, DeVore said it's being tossed around like a hot potato.
So they're shoveling it around in circles because nobody wants to touch it. That's what's going on.
Separate from the workers' compensation allegations, Thornley faces overtime fraud charges in a Sangamon County court in October. The Illinois Department of Human Services is restrained from relying on Governor J.B. Pritzker's COVID-19 executive orders limiting transfers from county jail inmates deemed unfit for trial. When a court orders criminal defendants unfit for trial, state law requires the detainees be transferred to state custody for a fitness evaluation within 20 days. That's not been done in a timely manner, in part because of monthly executive orders the governor first issued and modified since April 2020. Six county sheriffs sued DHS over the delays. The Sangamon County judge Thursday issued a temporary restraining order putting the sheriffs and DHS in the same position they were before the pandemic. Illinois Sheriffs Association Executive Director Jim Kaichek said delays were happening well before the pandemic. He said the situation's untenable.
Sheriffs across the state obviously have felt the pinch, as we've discussed before, about people being in their care for a longer period of time than they should be, in particular these folks, that they don't have the mental health services that these folks clearly need. So it's been an ongoing burden.
Kaichek said despite the court's temporary restraining order blocking the governor's executive order, sheriffs will still have to file local petitions with the court to transfer inmates if the state doesn't act.
It clearly was a win as it relates to the executive order. It's a win overall that they, you know, they're not allowed to violate the law because of the executive order, and that they need to try to find ways to get these people moving. But in order to finally get them to move, it may still be an unresolved issue to this point in time.
Thursday's temporary restraining order is in effect. Pending a hearing and decision on a preliminary injunction, it's possible the state could appeal the TRO. Meanwhile, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced more spending from the Rebuild Illinois plan with two infrastructure projects in southern Illinois, totaling nearly $40 million in state funds. Andrew Hensel has more.
The projects are funded from tax and fee increases imposed in 2019 and include $21.5 million to Cahokia Heights for wastewater improvements and another $17.5 million to clean up the Rend Lake Resort. Pritzker introduced the plans on Wednesday at two different news conferences.
So today I am very proud to announce that we will be investing more than $17 million to renovate Rend Lake Resort.
Republican State Rep. Charles Meyer questioned the announcement's timing, with it being closer to the election. In addition, Meyer said that the downstate city's other needs are not being met.
You can promise all you want. Come with the checkbook and the check in hand and deliver it if you want to give money to Southern Illinois. We believe in seeing it. We don't want to hear about it.
I'm Andrew Hensel.
The University of Illinois Flash Index, the measure of the state's economy, dropped in July. Kevin Bessler reports.
The index uses various metrics, including corporate earnings, tax receipts, and personal income to measure the level of economic activity around the state. The index measured the state's economy at 104.9 for July, down from 105.5 in June. Nationally, the GDP has declined for two straight quarters, signaling a possible recession.
GDP is going down, kind of both are happening. Most likely our spending is going down, probably due to the law of demand a little bit, just because prices are high, so people are having to kind of adjust what they're buying. And it also could mean that some people's wages are going down if layoffs are happening.
That is Northern Illinois University economics professor Tammy Batson. The author of the index notes that individual income tax and sales tax receipts have not kept pace with inflation over the last 3 months, while corporate tax receipts remain strong. I'm Kevin Bessler.
A new survey of over 3,500 small business owners shows many struggle to pay their rent. Andrew Hensel has that story.
The survey was conducted by Alignable and showed that 45% of small businesses in the nation are having difficulty paying their rents. According to Alignable's head researcher, Chuck Casto, Illinois sees a higher rate of mispayments than other states.
And Illinois in particular, for this particular survey, is in third place in terms of rent delinquency among small businesses.
Casto also discussed some of the things that Illinois fails to do to help small businesses.
Case in Illinois, and I believe in many other states too, but where they have the very high taxes, it's a cumulative effect with the small businesses.
In June, over 44% of Illinois small businesses surveyed said they could not pay their rent on time. I'm Andrew Hensel.
A sales tax holiday for school supplies begins Friday in Illinois, but a new report criticizes the practice as being ineffective. Kevin Bessler reports.
For 10 days, the state sales tax on school supplies drops from 6.25% to 1.25%. Governor J.B. Pritzker says this is one of the many financial initiatives brought forth during his administration.
Our back-to-school sales tax holiday is one of the many policies that we're deploying to put hundreds of dollars back in the pockets of Illinois' residents.
But Marco Guzman with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says sales tax holidays are too temporary to meaningfully change the regressive nature of a state's tax system.
Really, when you dig deep into them, they're ineffective. They're really poorly targeted. Wealthier taxpayers are able to take advantage of the same benefit that lower-income people are.
The report says policymakers seeking to achieve greater tax fairness would do better to provide a permanent refundable low-income sales tax credit. I'm Kevin Bessler.
And Illinois voters across the state face some of the most competitive elections in quite some time. Last week, local Democrat and Republican officials across the state slated candidates where their party didn't run a primary election. Seven Democrats were slated for state house seats. Republicans filed 27 names for open seats. Four independent and new party candidates filed. Some objections are pending. An analysis shows of a total of 177 state house seats, 28 of 118 house seats remain uncontested, with 27 of 59 Senate seats with no choice, or around 31% total. Historical analysis of Illinois House competitions shows around 24% of Illinois House seats in 2022 are uncompetitive, shrinking from 39% in 2020 and down from 50% in 2012. Illinois State Board of Elections spokesman Matt Dietrich said the next major date in the months ahead is August 26th to certify the November ballot. Some dates voters should remember.
August 10th, that's the first day that you can apply for a vote-by-mail ballot with your local election authority. And then early voting starts on September 29th at the office of your county clerk or board of election. So those are the big two dates coming up as far as voters are concerned.
The election is November 8th. Those are the top stories from the past week for Illinois. Find more online at americastalking.com. Coming up for Illinois in Focus, commentary from the Center Square publisher Chris Krug and executive editor Dan McCaleb. This is Illinois in Focus, the production of America's Talking Network. I'm Greg Bishop.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Illinois Focus podcast. This is the Crosstalk segment, commentary powered by the Center Square. I'm Chris Krug, publisher of the Center Square, joined, as always, or most of the time, by my friend and colleague, executive editor, Dan McCaleb. Dan, what's cooking?
Hey, good morning, Chris. You do a lot of traveling in your work life. I don't do near as much. I've been on the road this week, and I'll tell you, I now realize how much it can wear you down.
It's not fun. And if you're in a different time zone, man.
As I am, you, yes.
It gets to me. But it's good. It's good stuff. You get to see the country. I mean, you know, then that's the benefit of it. You know, the perspective that you gain from being somewhere else for some period of time. And then you bring that back to Illinois, and it helps you to think, you know, a little bit more clearly about what it is you're seeing and what it is you're not seeing, right? We still may see a Bears stadium built in Arlington Heights, but the city of Chicago continues to make pitch after pitch after pitch to keep the Bears in Chicago, in the city, at Soldier Field. And story from this week was that the only real way to make that happen, per reports, is taxpayer funded improvements to the facility. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't NFL teams, aren't the value of NFL teams among the largest in all of pro sports across the world, even when you get into European soccer clubs and things like that? The Bears' value, and therefore the Bears' owners' net value, is in the billions and billions of dollars. Why should taxpayers have to support a billionaire owner of a team that's worth billions of dollars to help renovate a stadium? And well, that's not the only other part of it. Is there's mega, we're not there yet in the process, but if the Bears continue down the road of moving to Arlington Heights and building a stadium there, there's no doubt they're going to be asking for state taxpayer and perhaps local taxpayer support to build the new stadium. So taxpayers, one way or the other, taxpayers may be on the hook either way.
Well, so, you know, it just came out this week, and I believe it was Forbes rankings. Not sure who it was. Who? Sportico. I don't know for what that's worth. It's getting a lot of run, but there's a, you know, they put out a list of the values of the NFL franchises and ranked them number one to number 32. And the Chicago Bears are the fifth most valuable franchise, according to this data, with a net estimated value of $5 billion. The Dallas Cowboys came in first at $7.64 billion. I believe that when the Cowboys built their crazy big stadium, right, the AT&T sponsored ballpark in Dallas
with the Jumbotron that like
right like the
TV world
massive, yeah. That they, I thought that was largely, if not wholly, privately funded.
Of course, that could be the case, but we at the Center Square, where we cover all 50 states, of course this is the Illinois in Focus podcast, we've written a lot in recent months about the Tennessee Titans,
yes,
wanting to build a new stadium in Nashville and seeking, and it looks like receiving, more than $1 billion in taxpayer funds to build that. Of course, the teams, the NFL teams, and it's not just NFL, it's other sports franchises, other sports leagues. They work with like local economic development boards to create these economic impact statements. Well, if taxpayers invest $1 billion to help us build this stadium, it's going to create 10,000 new jobs and provide a $15 billion, and I'm making these numbers up, $15 billion in economic impact to the community. But those economic impact studies have largely been debunked because it never happens.
Yeah, I mean, so the drama and saga continue. I don't know what's going to happen here, Dan. I mean,
let me ask you, as a former sports journalist who mm-hmm. covered the Bears many years ago, you are old, so it's been a while.
Yes.
But what's your take on, because you've been to Soldier Field covering games many times. If you had a what taking the taxpayer money out of it. I think we are both in agreement that taxpayers should not be subsidizing billionaire sports team owners. What's the better location for the Bears?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, the being on the lakefront, it's a really cool place for a stadium. The problem though is with this stadium itself, right? I mean, and this is largely a Bears problem, not a city of Chicago problem. I mean, the Bears would like to have a stadium where they can have, you know, more luxury suites and better amenities. And having a roof ultimately or potentially, you know, over the facility in the kind of weather that we have would, in theory, lead to more gate. When you look at the demographics and the spending on sports tickets, you know, and sports sponsorship and ultimately like suite sales and things like that, I think that the vast majority of the people that can afford to go to an NFL game or work for a company, you know, who have executives that would be using these kinds of suites a lot of them live in the suburbs. And so having the stadium in the suburbs, I can see where the Bears would see that as being valuable. Certainly the city of Chicago, you get the whole enchilada. You get all the beauty, all the history. And, you know, if you want to have a football team that's playing in it, you get all the problems. Because those things don't come, you know, a la carte. You get what you get. And I think that maybe there's a feeling in the suburbs that if the Bears were a little bit closer to where people lived, that there would be more Bears fans in the seats. And I think that the Bears are sensitive to that. They're aware of that. And I don't think that there's any, you know, anything that would prevent the Chicago Bears remaining the Chicago Bears if they just happen to move out to Arlington Heights.
My perspective, and I am a suburban resident along the Metra rail line. I'm at the Metra rail line, the Northwest line that passes by Arlington Park. So I fully share that I have my own bias there. Getting to Soldier Field from the suburbs is, God, it's just awful. A hassle.
It's awful. It is awful. It is awful. Take the train and walk. Take the train and get an Uber. Drive to the stadium. You're talking about hours of preparation and execution, and then you have to get out.
Right.
You know, so
and it's a miserable experience for me anyway, overall. So regardless of whether it's in Chicago, if Chicago can make a deal work, whether they build in Arlington Heights at the former racetrack, taxpayers should not be burdened with the cost.
I agree with you. It's just and right now, what is it? Is it the Americans for Prosperity chapter in Illinois is really working very hard to get the board members of the city of Arlington Heights to sign on to a pledge to not incur taxpayer debt or responsibility for the construction of a new stadium?
Yeah, they released a proposed resolution that they want this, the Arlington Heights City Council to adopt that essentially, bottom line, what it says is don't participate in corporate welfare programs.
Yeah.
Don't dedicate local tax dollars to helping build a new stadium that they will own, that they will control, et cetera.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see how Arlington Heights manages this. I mean, the former Arlington race course, easily in the top two or three most beautiful horse tracks in the country, of course, is now shuttered. That industry is, you know, it just isn't what it used to be.
Yeah.
Which is too bad because it's a beautiful sport. It's a shame that it would be used for nothing or would be, you know, done away with. The grounds are gorgeous. It really would be a spectacular venue. And with the access to the UP Northwest line, which runs all the way to Chicago, it also runs all the way out to Harvard. You know, I can see that as being a cool experience.
Yeah. Comes the major conflict that I think is probably going to mean taxpayers are going to be footing a large portion of the bill. You now have the city of Chicago and the city of Arlington Heights in a bidding war over the fifth most valuable
NFL
franchise. And that's not good for taxpayers.
Right. They're worth $5 billion, Dan.
Yeah.
Chicago Bears are worth $5 billion. Maybe. All right. Well, I mean, that's an issue that we're going to be keeping an eye on. And, you know, I mean, it's not resolving anytime soon. You know, the idea of building this stadium, I mean, is really, frankly, just an idea at this point. So, plenty of time for us to pick at that later. Something slightly more urgent is Amendment 1, which has not gotten a lot of conversation around it just yet. That is it's a ballot initiative that will be on the ballot for voters in Illinois here in November. And it's a proposed codification to the Illinois Constitution regarding public sector benefits and pensions. And this gets into area where, you know, some people are listening are like, oh, okay, now it's time for me to turn this off. And well, this is going to be dreadfully boring. And let me make it a little bit more interesting for you. Amendment one, I mean, with regard to what is at stake here, that codification could be really expensive for Illinoisans. And so we tend to look at things through a taxpayer's lens first. I mean, it's absolutely, you know, the hallmark of our editorial brand at the Center Square. So when you're looking at Amendment one, Dan, what do you see and what needs to be discussed at this point?
Well, yeah, you mentioned that it would codify like union benefits and union pensions in the state constitution, but it would do more than that. It would codify all union contracts, that meaning even in, for example, a state of an emergency, state government, Governor Pritzker, or whoever the governor is after November's elections, couldn't do anything about union contracts. And the Illinois Policy Institute put out a report this week that would include health issues. We, of course, just came through the COVID-19 pandemic, where schools shut down for months and months. We know the learning loss that students experienced, students across the spectrum, but lower income students, minority students, were more dramatically impacted by these school shutdowns. And of course, when much of the state was returning to school, Chicago Public Schools said that they were not going back to school because their contract had certain safety measures in place that they did not have to return to school and their students. So Chicago Public School students were out much longer and facing remote learning for much longer periods of time than other schools across the state. And essentially what this would do, in addition to codifying in the state constitution the pay and health care and other benefits and pensions and whatnot, these union contracts would be codified to the point where if you have another health crisis, school board union or school unions essentially would decide the fate of the students in their districts. It is wide ranging, and it gives way, way, way too much power to public sector unions. And I mean, I'm not going to tell anybody how to vote, but please be an aware voter, an educated voter, learn about what this would mean to you, to your family, to the taxes that you pay, who's going to control what happens at schools when your students are going to school, things like that. Get yourself educated on it, because you're right, this has not been widely, this is a huge change that unions want to make to the state constitution. It will have long-term and wide-ranging effects. You need to learn before you go to the ballot box in November. And granted, you know, you've got the governor's race is on the ballot. That's going to be the number one topic that people are thinking about. Who's going to be our next governor? Is Governor Pritzker going to be reelected? Is downstate Senator Darren Bailey, the Republican, on the ballot? Is he going to be elected? Those are the races. That's the race. And you got Attorney General and you got your local legislatures. Those are the races that are going to be the focal point.
Right.
But do not ignore this amendment, because it could have just as big impact on your pocketbook and the decisions that your local schools make as who becomes governor of the state of Illinois.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some estimates, you know, where the average homeowner, that their property taxes as a consequence of Amendment 1, if it were to go through, on average would go up something like, what was it, $2,200?
And Illinoisans already pay the second highest property taxes in the country by most analyses.
Right.
Do you want to risk having your property taxes going up even higher?
No, I don't personally. The other thing, you know, that sort of, I'd say, like, kind of sticks out about Amendment 1 is the fact that, You're talking about, you know, affording a specific class of workers exemptions and exceptions above the state's constitution. It seems very odd to me, and frankly unnecessary. I mean, when you look at it, I mean, that aspect of it, I think, kind of really, that's a jagged edge for me.
Yeah, Illinois is already very pro-union. We're not a right to work state. In the public sector, labor unions already, you know, dominate agenda setting or whatnot. This is definitely a power grab by public sector unions, and voters just need to be aware of it. You vote your mind, but know what the consequences would be.
Dan, you know, keeping it, you know, in the same realm of conversation around, you know, the economics, of course, but broadening it out and heading over toward education for a moment. We had a story this week at the Center Square, Illinois, about the cost of college and the impact that inflation is having on the cost of college. And then from a survey that we cite in that story from Intelligent, that of over 1,000 college students surveyed, it showed that nearly one in four would be forced to drop some or all of their classes if their tuition and costs increased by 5%. And I was looking at this at face value, and I was thinking, geez, I mean, you know, aren't we seeing roughly 5% increases every single year in the college environment? I mean, you and I both have college age students. I mean, from the standpoint of billing, unless, you know, the college is committed to, you know, flat pricing, so when when your kids enter into the school, that, you know, that the tuition will not escalate above it. Some schools do that, but most schools, my understanding is they don't, and they're all subject to increases. But what's the driving effect of inflation in addition to that?
In addition to the outrageous costs of tuition going to a university in Illinois and other states, it's not just contained to Illinois, but Illinois has seen tuition skyrocket over the past two decades, more so than most other states. You know, students have to eat, they have to live, they have to buy textbooks, they have to buy other course material, you know, and inflation, due in large part by government spending, by the increase in government spending during the COVID-19 pandemic, and all the free money, the quote unquote free money that was given out during the pandemic. That's largely what's driven inflation that has averaged more than 9% year over year for the past several months. So the cost of everything for college students is going up. And remember, these are college students. Their first priority is school. So their first priority is not work. Their first priority is school. Many college students need to and do get part-time jobs, but that's the extent. They can get part-time jobs that, you know, frankly, pay lower than full-time jobs do. And students just can't keep up with the rising costs. So in addition to significantly high tuition, they have to pay to eat, they have to pay to live. And that's, as inflation is impacting the college setting as well. Just like it's impacted everybody across all, across all age groups, across all professional groups, mostly impacting lower income residents more because they have less discretionary impact to pay for things. And you might tend to think of, depending on your perspective, of college students, they're mostly coming from, you know, upper middle class and higher class families, but that's not the case. You have single moms, single dads trying to better themselves, trying to improve themselves so they can take better care of their families, who are working or who are living paycheck to paycheck, and inflation has just had dramatic impacts on them. on those types of situations. And it's just not a good thing for the economy. It's not the good thing for families. It's not a good thing for individuals who want to do the right thing, earn the skills so they can go out there and be a contributing member of society. And this is just another example of how increased government spending is hurting American families.
Yeah, I mean, the affordability aspect of college is bananas, you know. And at the same time, I mean, you know, we're participants in my household in the state's Bright Start, you know, 529 program, and Rude Awakening last two quarters have just been brutal. I mean, literally brutal in terms of what's going on with the fund. The fund management there is, you know, eerily quiet. This is a program that was trumpeting, you know, the results that they were getting. They were riding the wave of a bull market and actually getting results, frankly, in some cases that were below, I think, what you would be able to go out and get on your own prior to, you know, the first quarter of this year. Well, I mean, those funds are tanking. I mean, because they're clearly not very well diversified. And so, I mean, if you're saving for college as an Illinois resident through that mechanism, and you got rising costs on the other side, it's a double whammy. It's an absolute double whammy. So not super great news for people with college age students, and certainly for the college age students who, in all likelihood, Dan, are going to have to take out more loans and you know, subscribe to a different level of indebtedness, starting their lives and their careers a little bit in the hole.
Yeah, but we don't have to worry about that because President Biden's going to forgive student loans.
Sure, you betcha. You betcha. I look forward to seeing that on the financials.
Yeah.
Which
of course has its other impacts, like further driving up inflation and further making everything cost more. But, you know, it's cyclical.
Dan, this Jenny Thornley case is just not going away. And you and I had a chance to talk about this last week. There was the matter of the question that that the center square posed that you know, Marianne Ahern asked on our behalf because we had a staffing issue, couldn't actually be physically present at the governor's stand up. And wow, did they fumble their way through their explanation of why the state attorney general's office is not involving itself in the Jenny Thornley matter. I don't think I've ever seen Kwame Raoul be more uncomfortable in answering a question. You know, the derisive remarks that Governor Pritzker made about the center square are par for the course. He doesn't like hard questions. He doesn't like people, you know, really poking around in his matters, even though he's a public official. He's going to have a really tough time. I mean, when he comes up and out of, you know, the super soft Illinois media market, you know, if he does make a run for president, you know, which he's been auditioning for this summer, I mean, he's going to have a really tough time. But Kwame Raoul and Kwame Raoul's unwillingness to answer the question straight about why his office isn't doing anything with regard to Jenny Thornley is very interesting. Or maybe I shouldn't say isn't doing anything. They were giving off the appearance that they're doing something, but nobody's really certain ultimately what that something might be. And they're not moving with any sense of urgency around this former staffer turned whistleblower, turned accused fraudster. Where are we with this story?
This is, as we talked about last week, it is a complex story that has all kinds of political tentacles tied to it. Just a brief background, Jenny Thornley worked for Governor Pritzker's campaign 4 years ago, then got a job with state government, the State Police Merit Board. It has been alleged, and she has been charged with essentially charging her employer, the state of Illinois, for overtime hours that she did work. She's not been proven guilty of anything, but she's been charged with more than 20 counts of fraud when it comes to overtime and other also government turning in expenses that the that prosecutors say were fraudulent. So she's innocent until proven guilty. She's just been accused of a crime, just been charged with a crime right now. But then when this was going on, when these criminal proceedings were going on, she made allegations of sexual misconduct by her supervisor and filed for workers' compensation insurance, which is essentially she's claiming that this the sexual harassment, the sexual impropriety caused her not to be able to do her job, so she would get paid by taxpayer dollars for work, her workers' compensation claim. That so far has not been. So the sexual misconduct allegations were investigated twice by the state of Illinois, found to be unfounded after $500,000 in taxpayer money were spent. The allegations by Jenny Thornley were found to be unfounded, but yet she still continued to collect workers' compensation insurance. She's made no. She's invoked Governor Pritzker, and Governor Pritzker's wife is saying she's close to them in various documents, court documents and otherwise, that we've seen, we at the Center Square have seen. So she makes no bones about it that she's close to Governor Pritzker. The workers' compensation fraud cases was referred to Attorney General Kwame Raoul. He said he referred it to a special prosecutor, an appellate court prosecutor. He's given a number of reasons for why he's done that. First, because the appellate prosecutor investigated the OT, the fraudulent overtime claims against her, and that it would be more appropriate for the special prosecutor, the appellate prosecutor, to investigate the case, even though the Attorney General's office investigates workers' comp cases all of the time. Kwame Raoul's challenger on the November ballot, Attorney Tom DeVore, has pointed out those very contradictory statements by Kwame Raoul, saying that this should be investigated by the state's Attorney General's office, mm-hmm. yet it is not. Kwame Raoul said he assented to the appellate prosecutor. The appellate prosecutor says he's never received such a referral from the AG's office. So this has been months and months in the making, and still there's no investigation of the alleged workers' compensation fraud against Jenny Thornley. Raoul has since said that, well, there's a conflict of interest within his office because she works for state government, which also doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And what we need to know is what's going on politically with this case? How close is Governor Pritzker to Jenny Thornley? Has he intervened on her behalf?
Mm-hmm.
Has he and Kwame Raoul, the state's attorney general, conferred about this? Why is what would seem to be a routine criminal investigation of alleged workers' comp fraud being passed around? No one wants to touch it. Something deeper is going on here.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what and when they knew it and what it means? These are the questions that are still outstanding. The oddity of this, I think, is the fact that when Governor J.B. Pritzker took over, after the 2018 election, one of the statements that he made was that, and this being a new day for Illinois, was around transparency in the office. When Michael Madigan, fell into, into the net of the DOJ, Department of Justice, last year, he talked about the need for corruption to be rooted out of the process. And, while there may be no corruption here, there's no transparency. So how would you ever know? And the fact that they have dealt with this in a very specific way, clearly outside of the protocol of a normal case because of whatever involvement there is between Jenny Thornley and the governor and the governor's wife and the governor's top advisor, Ann Caprera. This just looks bad. And so why don't we just fess up and say what, you know, like bring it forward. Be transparent. What actually happened here? Why are you handling this in a different way?
Well, and that makes it appear that they're trying to cover something up.
Not if they're making it worse. Up. Whatever it is whatever it is. And I mean, if Jenny Thornley, you know, I mean, look, this is going to be very interesting for her, right? I mean, but inside of all this has been, you know, in the discovery of documents that were back and forth. I think there were emails. Jenny Thornley, you know, somewhat makes like, I don't know how you'd say that, like a latent threat, you know, like it would be sort of, you know, bad for everybody if this got out kind of statement in one of her emails. Yes. So.
Yeah, it's mind boggling. And as you said, it does make it look worse. And maybe it is worse. We don't know. That's the problem.
Well, maybe it is worse.
But in Illinois, with all of the corruption that we've seen in the past in Illinois government, it makes people like you and me who pay attention more suspicious that there might be something deeper here. And I think anyone who's followed the story, and of course, the Center Square has kind of has really dominated the reporting on this story. While there has been reports in other media outlets, it's not been as extensive as our reporting has been on it. We're getting to the point now where this should be a major, major story from Chicago to Carbondale to Springfield, because there's something going on here, and the lack of transparency by both AG Kwame Ruhl and Governor J.B. Pritzker is astounding. They need to get in front of the microphone and answer tough questions about what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I thought their performance, I mean, the fact that they dragged the Center Square for asking this question, you know, through Marianne Ahern, which, you know, I mean, that's thanks to her for being willing to ask that question. It's our question. I think it's a fair question. And if she didn't think it was a fair question, I'm assuming she wouldn't have asked it. But, you know, we need some answers. And whatever that performance was, you know, in that presser where the question was asked, I mean, that's you talk about people that look uncomfortable. Give me a break.
One thing I don't think we did here is we are recording today or this week's podcast on Thursday, August 4th. We are Governor Pritzker does have a couple of public appearances on his schedule today. He very well could be asked again about this. So follow the Center Square, at thecentersquare.com for any updates, any developments over the course of the next several days.
Absolutely. Dan, last thing I want to talk about is monkeypox. I've been, you know, just for the people that are listening at home, I've been sending you snapshots of the emergence of monkeypox via these little graphics that the CDC creates for, I don't know how long, 2 months, 3 months.
I was gonna say a couple of days now, maybe.
Get out of here. Get out of here. I've been sending these to you ever since they started to roll across my Facebook feed because I thought they were kind of interesting. And so now monkeypox is upon us here in Illinois. We actually have, I guess it would be a disaster declaration from Governor Pritzker. We have, as of August 1st, we have 520 cases. And the numbers seem like they're continuing to grow. The aspect of monkeypox that I thought would be interesting to talk about is maybe the sensitivity at which this has been reported elsewhere and how that has maybe not been to the benefit of public health. Have we not learned anything about direct communication with regard to, you know, ultimately scary things? I mean, monkeypox there's a vaccine for it. The number of fatalities associated with monkeypox is it's an infinitesimally small number, right? but our unwillingness to talk about sort of what's, you know, what's driving monkeypox until recently, I think is kind of embarrassing. I mean, the reality of it is that this is largely, you know, a sexually transmitted virus, and it specifically is, you know, from a transmission standpoint, from male to male. And I mean, 95% of cases, as per reporting from the CDC, and finally, as reported recently by some of the larger media companies in this country, 95% of these cases are transmitted, male to male and sexually. So why is it that we can't have these conversations? I mean, you and I both grew up in the business, you know, and saw how, you know, those people who had AIDS or HIV and then ultimately AIDS were demonized. There was a general lack of sensitivity. In fact, you could even pull, you know, old school Tony Fauci, you know, who was the health czar then, into that conversation, and look at the disservice that he did in the way that he framed the problem. Why can't we be more open about things such as this today? And I mean, because it's not going to stay inside of that community. It is ultimately going to spread outside of that community, which is exactly what happened with HIV transmission. I don't know. Are we talking 30 years ago now? 35 years ago?
Yeah. That was obviously HIV and AIDS was a huge, huge public health issue back in the 80s. And into the 90s, and it's still an issue today, but obviously not near as severe as it was when we were first learning about it, just like the COVID-19 pandemic. If your sole interest is the public health, then you absolutely need to be talking about this. This largely so far is affecting gay men, and it's sexually transmitted. The vast majority of the cases we found are within the community, within the gay community. If your interest is more political in nature, maybe that makes you hesitate to talk about it because of this huge surge in recent years of a focus on the LGBTQ community and their rights. Nothing wrong with that, but this is a public health issue. Governor Pritzker created a public health or issued a public emergency over monkeypox. We need to be more willing, the media in general, on the population at large, and talking about what's causing this and what you need to do to protect yourself from contracting a disease like this.
Yeah, it bothers me because, you know, I mean, we just had two major events in Chicago. Within the last, I guess it would be 45 days. I mean, amidst the backdrop that, you know, that is monkeypox, Pride, and the Chicago Pride Fest, right? And then Lollapalooza, where these are mass events. Where were the public? Where were the calls to action and the public service announcements, and the awareness campaigns that could have at the very least alerted people to the reality of monkeypox in Chicago specifically and in Illinois generally? And now we've got another declaration of emergency. You know, I mean, it's just why can't we get out of our own way on the political side of life in Illinois? Why can't we do things that are more forward-looking and thoughtful and honest and sincere? Why do we not? It just drives me nuts about how Illinois is governed. I mean, we're willing to do an emergency, you know, on the back end of it, but what about the preventive measures that we could have done on the front end, in particular around those two events, mass events that were hosted inside the city of Chicago?
It's because politics, unfortunately, have too much clout when it comes to even something as basic as public health issues, unfortunately. I agree with your perspective completely. What we need to do and what we should have been doing for several weeks, even months now, is issuing those public alerts that this is who it's infecting right now. This is how it's transmitted. Please protect yourself. So you are better able to protect yourself from contracting something like monkeypox. And that really, that didn't happen.
No, zero. And now we have an emergency declaration. It's maddening. And it's really, really frustrating. Hey, Dan, out of time. A pleasure as always. Safe travels. Enjoy these United States. Bring home good ideas wherever you may be in this world.
I actually have several good ideas that I got from the people that I talked to and met face-to-face. It was really some refreshing conversations.
That's dynamite. For Dan McCaleb, executive editor of the Center Square, this has been Chris Krug, publisher of the Center Square. You've been listening to the Crosstalk segment commentary powered by the Center Square here in Illinois. Now over to Greg Bishop for a look at what the Center Square will be working on right here in Illinois next week.
Next week, the team from the Center Square will track the latest developments in the upcoming election, which is in 3 months' time, evaluate the state's economy, and prepare for the Illinois State Fair. This has been Illinois in Focus, a production of America's Talking Network. I'm Greg Bishop.